strike. Be with you in a bit.
He hung up.
It's a massage parlour, he told Robin, examining the map, but not the kind you'd take your bad knee to.
Really? She said, startled.
They're everywhere, he said. You know that.
He understood why she was disconcerted. The scene beyond the windscreen, St. Dionysius, the godly grammar school on stilts, a busy and prosperous high street, a St. George's cross rippling in the breeze outside a nearby pub, might have appeared on a poster advertising the town.
What are you going to... Where is it? Asked Robin.
Not far away, he said, showing her on the map. I'm going to need a cash point first.
Was he actually going to pay for a massage? Robin wondered, startled. But she did not know how to frame the question, and nor was she sure that she wanted to hear the answer. After pulling in at a cash point to enable Strike to increase his overdraft by another £200, she followed his directions onto St. Mary's Road, which lay at the end of the main street. St. Mary's Road proved to be a perfectly respectable-looking thoroughfare, lined with estate agents, beauty spas and solicitors, most of them in large, detached buildings.
That's it, said Strike,
pointing as they drove past a discreet establishment that sat on a corner. A glossy purple and gold sign read, Thai Orchid Massage. Only the dark blinds on the windows hinted at activities beyond the medically sanctioned manipulation of sore joints. Robin parked in a side street and watched Strike until he passed out of sight. Approaching the massage parlour's entrance, Strike noticed that the orchid depicted on the glossy sign overhead looked remarkably like a vulva. He rang the bell, and the door was opened instantly by a long-haired man, almost as tall as himself.
I just phoned, Strike said.
The bouncer grunted and nodded Strike through a pair of thick black inner curtains. Immediately inside was a small carpeted lounge area with two sofas, where an older Thai woman sat along with two Thai girls, one of whom looked about 15. A TV in the corner was showing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. The girl's expressions changed from bored to alert as he entered. The older woman stood up. She was vigorously chewing gum.
You call, yeah?
That's right, said Strike.
You want drink?
No, thanks.
You like Thai girl?
Yep, said Strike.
Who you want?
Her, said Strike, pointing at the younger girl, who was dressed in a pink halter neck, suede miniskirt, and cheap-looking patent stilettos.
She smiled and stood up. Her skinny legs reminded him of a flamingo's.
Okay, said his interlocutor. You pay now, got private booth after, okay?
Strike handed over £90, and his chosen girl beckoned, beaming. She had the body of an adolescent boy, except for the clearly fake breasts, which reminded him of the plastic Barbies on Ellen's daughter's shelf. The private booth was accessed down a short corridor, a small room with a single black-blinded window and low lighting. It was suffused with the smell of sandalwood. A shower had been crammed into the corner. The massage table was of fake black leather.
You want shower first?
No, thanks, said Strike.
Okay, you take off clothes in there, she said,
pointing at a tiny curtained-off corner in which Strike would have had great difficulty concealing his 6'3" frame.
I'm happier with my clothes on. I want to talk to you.
She did not seem fazed. She had seen all sorts.
You want top off?
She offered brightly, reaching for the bow behind her neck.
£10 extra, top off.
No, said Strike.
Hand relief,
she offered, eyeing his flies.
Hand relief with oil, 20 extra.
No, I just want to talk to you, said Strike.
Doubt crossed her face, and then a sudden flash of fear.
You police?
No, said Strike, holding up his hands as though surrendering to her. I'm not police. I'm looking for a man called Noel Brockbank. He used to work here, on the door, I expect. Probably the bouncer.
He had chosen this particular girl because she looked so young. Knowing Brockbank's proclivities, he thought Brockbank might have sought contact with her rather than any of the other girls. but she shook her head.
"He gone," she said.
"I know," said Strike. "I'm trying to find out where he went."
"Mama sack him."
Was the owner her mother, or was it an honorary title? Strike preferred not to involve Mama in this. She looked shrewd and tough. He had an idea he would be forced to pay well for what might turn out to be no information at all. There was a welcome naivety about his chosen girl. She could have charged him for confirmation that Brockbank had once worked there, that he had been sacked, but it had not occurred to her.
"Did you know him?" Strike asked.
"He sacked week I come," she said.
"Why was he sacked?"
The girl glanced at the door.
"Would anyone here have a contact number for him, or know where he went?"
She hesitated. Strike took out his wallet.
20, he said. "If you can introduce me to someone who's got information on where he is now, that's yours to keep."
She stood playing with the hem of her suede skirt like a child, staring at him. Then tweaked the tenors out of his hand and tucked them deep into her skirt pocket.
"Wait here."
He sat down on the fake leather massage table and waited. The little room was as clean as any spa, which Strike liked. He found dirt deeply an aphrodisiac. It always reminded him of his mother and Whittaker in that fetid squat, of stained mattresses, and the miasma of his stepfather thick in his nostrils. Here, beside the oils neatly lined up in a side cabinet, erotic thoughts could hardly fail to occur. The idea of a full body-to-body naked massage with oil was far from unpleasing. For no reason that he could think of, his thoughts jumped to Robin, sitting outside in the car. He got briskly to his feet again, as though he had been discovered doing something compromising, and then angry Thai voices sounded close at hand. The door burst open to reveal Mama and his chosen girl, who looked frightened.
"You pay for one girl massage," said Mama angrily.
Like her protege, her eyes found his flies. She was checking to see whether any business had already been done, whether he was trying to get more on the cheap.
"He changed mind," said the girl desperately. "He want two girl, one Thai, one blonde. We do nothing. He changed mind."
"You pay for one girl only,"
shouted Mama, pointing at Strike with a talon-tipped finger. Strike heard heavy footsteps and guessed that the long-haired doorman was approaching.
"I'm happy," he said, inwardly cursing, "to pay for the two-girl massage as well."
120 more,"
Mama shouted at him, unable to believe her ears.
"Yes," he said, "fine."
She made him come back out into the lounge area to pay. An overweight redhead was sitting there in a cut-out black lycra dress. She looked hopeful.
"He want blonde,"
said Strike's accomplice as he handed over another £120, and the redhead's face fell.
"Ingrid with client,"
said Mama, shoving Strike's cash in a drawer.
"You wait here till she finish."
So he sat between the skinny Thai girl and the redhead and watched Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, until a small, suited man with a white beard came scurrying out of the corridor and, avoiding eye contact with anybody, disappeared through the black curtains and escaped onto the street. 5 minutes later, a slim peroxide blonde, who, Strike thought, must be around his own age, appeared in purple lycra and thigh-high boots.
"You go with Ingrid," said Mama.
And Strike and the Thai girl traipsed obediently back to the private parlour.
"He no want massage,"
Strike's first girl told the blonde breathlessly when the door was closed.
"He want know where Noel went."
The blonde eyed Strike, frowning. She might be no more than twice the age of her companion, but she was good-looking, with dark brown eyes and high cheekbones.
"What you want him for?"
she asked in pure Essex, and then calmly,
"Are you pleased?"
"No,"
said Strike. Sudden comprehension was illuminating her pretty face.
"Hang on,"
she said slowly.
"I know who you are. You're that Strike, you're Cameron Strike, the detective who solved the Lula Landry case, and, Jesus, didn't someone just send you a leg?"
Yeah, they did. Noel was fucking obsessed with you, she said. All I ever heard him talk about, practically, after you was on the news.
Is that right?
Yeah. He kept saying you give him a brain injury.
I can't take full credit. You knew him well, did you?
Not that well, she said, correctly interpreting Strike's meaning. I knew his friend from up north, John. He was a great guy. One of my regular punters before he went off to Saudi. Yeah, they was at school together, I think. He felt sorry for Noel because he was ex-forces and he had a few problems, so he recommended him for here. Said he was down on his luck. He got me to rent Noel a room in my place and all.
Her tone said plainly that she felt John's sympathy for Brockbank had been misplaced.
How did that go?
He was all right at first, but once his guard come down, he just ranted all the time. About the army, about you, about his son. He's obsessed with his son, getting his son back. He says it's your fault he can't see him, but I don't see how he works that out. Anybody could see why his ex-wife didn't want him near the kid.
And why's that?
Mama found him with her granddaughter on his lap and his hand up her skirt, said Ingrid. She's six.
Ah, said Strike.
He left owing me 2 weeks' rent, and that's the last I ever saw of him. Good bloody riddance.
Do you know where he went after he was sacked?
No idea.
So you haven't got any contact details?
I've probably still got his mobile number, she said. I don't know whether he'll still be using it.
Could you give... Do I look like I've got a mobile on me? She asked, raising her arms high.
The lycra and boots outlined every curve. Her erect nipples were clearly visible through the thin fabric. Invited to look, Strike forced himself to maintain eye contact.
Could you meet me later and give it to me?
We're not allowed to exchange contact details with punters. Terms and conditions, sweetheart. Why we're not allowed to carry phones?
Tell you what, she said, eyeing him up and down.
Seeing as it's you, and seeing as how I know you punched a bastard and you're a war hero and everything, I'll meet you up the road when I clock off.
That, said Strike, would be great. Thanks very much.
He did not know whether he imagined a flirtatious glint in her eye. Possibly he was distracted by the smell of massage oil and his recent thoughts of warm, slippery bodies. 20 minutes later, having waited long enough for Mama to assume that relief had been sought and given, Strike left the tight orchid and crossed the road to where Robin was waiting in the car.
£230 for an old mobile number, he said, as she pulled away from the curb and accelerated towards the town centre. I hope it's bloody worth it. We're looking for Adam and Eve Street. She says it's just up here on the right. The cafe's called Applebee's. She's going to meet me there in a bit.
Robin found a parking space and they waited, discussing what Ingrid had said about Brockbank while eating the Danish pastries that Strike had stolen from the breakfast buffet. Robin was starting to appreciate why Strike was carrying extra weight. She had never before undertaken an investigation that lasted more than 24 hours. When every meal had to be sourced in passing shops and eaten on the move, you descended quickly to fast food and chocolate.
That's her,
said Strike, 40 minutes later, clambering out of the Land Rover and heading for the interior of Applebee's. Robin watched the blonde approach, now in jeans and a fake fur jacket. She had the body of a glamour model, and Robin was reminded of Platinum. 10 minutes passed, then 15. Neither Strike nor the girl reappeared. How long does it take to hand over a telephone number? Robin asked the interior of the Land Rover crossly. She felt chilly in the car. I thought you wanted to get onto Corby. He had told her nothing had happened, but you never knew. Perhaps it had. Perhaps the girl had covered Strike in oil and... Robin drummed her fingers on the steering wheel. She thought about Ellen and how she would feel if she knew what Strike had done that day. Then, with a slight jolt, she remembered that she had not checked her phone to see whether Matthew had been in contact again. She took it out of her coat pocket and saw no new messages. Since telling him she was definitely not going to his father's birthday party, he had gone quiet. The blonde and Strike emerged from the cafe. Ingrid did not seem to want to let Strike go. When he waved farewell, she leaned forward and kissed him on the cheek, then sashayed away. Strike caught Robin watching and got back into the car with a kind of bashful grimace.
"That looked interesting," said Robin.
"Not really," said Strike,
showing her the number now keyed into his phone. Noel Brockbank Mobile.
"She was just chatty."
If Robin had been a male colleague, he would have found it impossible not to add,
"I was in there."
Ingrid had flirted shamelessly across the table, scrolling slowly through the contacts on her phone, wondering aloud whether she still had the number, so that he started to feel anxious that she had nothing, asking him whether he had ever had a proper Thai massage, probing about what he wanted Noel for, about the cases he had solved, especially that of the beautiful dead model, which had first brought him to public notice, and finally insisting, with a warm smile, that he take her number too.
Just in case.
"Do you want to try Brockbank's number now?" Robin asked, recalling Strike's attention from the back view of Ingrid as she walked away.
"What? No. That one's thinking about. We might only have one shot if he picks up."
He checked his watch.
"Let's get going. I don't want to be too late in court."
The phone in his hand rang.
"Wardle," said Strike.
He answered, putting the phone onto speaker so that Robin could listen.
"What's going on?"
"We've ID'd the body," said Wardle.
A note in his voice warned them that they were about to recognize a name. The tiny pause that followed allowed the image of that little girl with her small bird-like eyes to slide in panic through Strike's mind.
"She's called Kelsey Platt, and she's the girl who wrote to you for advice on how to cut off her leg. She was genuine, 16 years old."
Equal amounts of relief and disbelief crashed over Strike. He groped for a pen, but Robin was already writing.
"She was doing a City and Guilds in childcare at some vocational college, which is where she met Oksana Voloshina. Kelsey usually lived in Finchley with her half-sister and a sister's partner. She told them she was going away on a college placement for 2 weeks. They didn't report her missing, they weren't worried. She wasn't expected back until tonight. Oksana said Kelsey didn't get on with her sister and asked whether she could stay there for a couple of weeks, get some space. Looks like the girl had it all planned out, writing to you from that address. The sister's a total mess, understandably. I can't get much sense out of her yet, but she's confirmed the handwriting on the letter was genuine, and the thing the girl had about wanting to get rid of her leg didn't seem to come as a total shock to her. We've got DNA samples off the girl's hairbrush. It matches. It's her."
With a creak of the passenger seat, Strike leaned closer to Robin to read her notes. She could smell the cigarette smoke on his clothes and a tiny whiff of sandalwood.
"There's a partner living with a sister," he asked.
"A man?"
"You won't pin it on him," said Wardle. And Strike could tell that Wardle had already had a good try. 45, retired fireman, not in great nick. Knackered lungs and a watertight alibi for the weekend in question.
"The weekend?"
began Robin.
"Kelsey left her sisters on the night of April the 1st. We know she must have died on the 2nd or 3rd. You got handed her leg on the 4th. Strike, I'm going to need you back in here for more questions. Routine, but we're going to have to take a formal statement about those letters."
There seemed little else to be said. After accepting Strike's thanks for letting them know, Wardle rang off, leaving a silence that seemed to Robin to quiver with aftershocks. Chapter 28. Oh, Debbie Denise was true to me, she'd wait by the window so patiently. Blue Oyster Cult, Debbie Denise. Lyrics by Patti Smith.
"This whole trip's been a wasted detour. It isn't Brittany, it can't be Brockbank."
Strike's relief was stupendous. The colours of Adam and Eve Street seemed suddenly washed clean, the passers-by brighter, more likeable than they had been before he had taken the call. Brittany must, after all, be alive somewhere. This was not his fault. The leg had not been hers. Robin said nothing. She could hear the triumph in Strike's voice, feel his release. She, of course, had never met or seen Brittany Brockbank, and while she was glad the girl was safe, the fact remained that a girl had died in horrific circumstances. The guilt that had tumbled from Strike seemed to have fallen heavily into her own lap. She was the one who had skim-read Kelsey's letter and simply filed it in the nutter drawer without response. Would it have made a difference, Robin wondered, if she had contacted Kelsey and advised her to get help? Or if Strike had called her and told her that he had lost his leg in battle, that whatever she had been told about his injury was a lie? Robin's insides ached with regret. "Are you sure?" she said aloud, after a full minute's silence, both of them lost in their own private thoughts.
"Sure about what?" asked Strike, turning to look at her.
"That it can't be Brockbank."
"If it's not Brittany," began Strike.
"You've just told me that girl..."
"Ingrid."
"Ingrid," said Robin, with a trace of impatience. "Yes. You've just told me she says Brockbank's obsessed with you. He holds you accountable for his brain damage and the loss of his family." Strike watched her, frowning, thinking. "Everything I said last night about the killer wanting to denigrate you and belittle your war record would sit comfortably with everything we know about Brockbank," Robin went on. "And don't you think that meeting this Kelsey and perhaps seeing the scarring on her leg that was like Brittany's, or hearing that she wanted to get rid of it could have, I don't know, triggered something in him?" "I mean," said Robin tentatively, "we don't know exactly how the brain damage..."
"He's not that fucking brain damaged," snapped Strike. "He was faking it in the hospital. I know he was."
Robin said nothing, but sat behind the wheel and watched choppers moving up and down Adam and Eve Street. She envied them. Whatever their private preoccupations, they were unlikely to include mutilation and murder.
"You make some good points," said Strike at last.
Robin could tell that she had taken the edge off his private celebration. He checked his watch.
"Come on, we'd better get off to Corby if we're going to do it today."
The 12 miles between the two towns were swiftly covered. Robin guessed from his surly expression that Strike was mulling over their discussion about Brockbank. The road was nondescript, the surrounding countryside flat, hedgerows and occasional trees lining the route. "So, Lang," said Robin, trying to move Strike out of what seemed an uncomfortable reverie. "Remind me."
"Lang, yeah," said Strike slowly.
She was right to think that he had been lost in thoughts of Brockbank. Now he forced himself to focus, to regroup.
"Well, Lang tied up his wife and used a knife on her, accused of rape twice that I know of, but never done for it. And he tried to bite half my face off in the boxing ring. Basically a violent, devious bastard," said Strike. "But like I told you, his mother-in-law reckons he was ill when he got out of jail. She says he went to Gateshead, but he can't have stayed there long if he was living in Corby with this woman in 2008, he said, checking the map again for Lorraine McNaughton's road. "Right age, right time frame. We'll see. If Lorraine's not in, we'll go back after 5 o'clock.
Following Strike's directions, Robin drove through the very centre of Corby Town, which proved to be a sprawl of concrete and brick dominated by a shopping centre. A massive block of council offices, on which aerials bristled like iron moss, dominated the skyline. There was no central square, no ancient church, and certainly no stilted half-timbered grammar school. Corby had been planned to house its explosion of migrant workers in the 1940s and 1950s. Many of the buildings had a cheerless, utilitarian air. "Half the names are Scottish," said Robin, as they passed Argyle Street and Montrose Street.
"Used to call it Little Scotland, didn't they?" said Strike, noting a sign for Edinburgh House.
He had heard that in its industrial heyday, Corby had had the largest Scottish population south of the border. Salt eyes and lions rampant fluttered from balconies of flats.
You can see why Lang might have felt more at home here than in Gateshead. Could have had contacts in the area.
5 minutes later, they found themselves in the old part of town, whose pretty stone buildings retained traces of the village that Corby had been before the steelworks arrived. Shortly afterwards, they came upon Weldon Road, where Lorraine McNaughton lived. The houses stood in solid blocks of six, each pair a mirror image of the other, so that their front doors sat side by side and the layout of the windows was reversed. Carved into the stone lintel over each door was a name.
"That's hers," said Strike,
pointing at Summerfield, which was twinned with Northfield. Summerfield's front garden had been covered in fine gravel. Northfield's grass needed mowing, which reminded Robin of her own flat back in London.
"I think we'd both better go in," said Strike, unbuckling his seatbelt. "She'll probably be more comfortable with you there."
The doorbell seemed to be out of order. Strike therefore rapped sharply on the door with his knuckles. An explosion of furious barking told them that the house had at least one living inhabitant. Then they heard a woman's voice, angry but somehow ineffectual.
"Shh! Be quiet! Stop it! Shush! No!"
The door opened, and Robin had just caught a glimpse of a hard-faced woman of around 50 when a rough-coated Jack Russell came pelting out, growling and barking with ferocity, and sank its teeth into Strike's ankle. Fortunately for Strike, but less so for the Jack Russell, its teeth connected with steel. It yelped, and Robin capitalized on its shock by stooping swiftly, grabbing it by the scruff of the neck and lifting it up. So surprised was the dog at finding itself dangling in midair that it simply hung there.
"No biting," said Robin.
Apparently deciding that a woman brave enough to pick it up was worthy of respect, the dog allowed her to take a firmer grip, twisted in midair, and attempted to lick her hand.
"Sorry," said the woman. "He was my mother's. He's a bloody nightmare.
He likes you, look. Miracle."
Her shoulder-length brown hair had grey roots. Deep marionette lines lay either side of a thin-lipped mouth. She was leaning on a stick, one of her ankles swollen and bandaged, the foot encased in a sandal that displayed yellowing toenails. Strike introduced himself, then showed Lorraine his driving license and a business card.
"Are you Lorraine McNaughton?"
"Yeah,"
she said hesitantly. Her eyes flickered to Robin, who smiled reassuringly over the Jack Russell's head.
What did you say?"
"A detective," said Strike. "And I was wondering whether you could tell me anything about Donald Lang. Telephone records show he was living here with you a couple of years ago."
"Yeah, he was," she said slowly.
"Is he still here?" Strike asked, although he knew the answer.
"No."
Strike indicated Robin.
"Would it be all right if my colleague and I come in and ask you a few questions? We're trying to find Mr. Lang."
There was a pause. Lorraine chewed her inner lip, frowning. Robin cradled the Jack Russell, which was now enthusiastically licking her fingers, where no doubt it could taste traces of Danish pastry. Strike's torn trouser leg flapped in a light breeze.
"All right, come in," said Lorraine,
and she backed away on her crutches to admit them. The frowsy front room smelled strongly of stale cigarette smoke. There were countless old ladyish touches, crocheted tissue box covers, cheap frilled cushions, and an array of fancily dressed teddy bears arranged on a polished sideboard. One wall was dominated by a painting of a saucer-eyed child dressed as a Pierrot. Strike could no more imagine Donald Lang living here than he could visualize a bullock bedded down in the corner. Once inside, the Jack Russell scrabbled to get down out of Robin's arms, then started barking at Strike again.
"Oh, shut up,"
groaned Lorraine. Sinking down onto the faded brown velvet sofa, she used both arms to lift her bandaged ankle back onto a leather pouf, reached sideways to retrieve her pack of Super Kings, and lit up.
"I'm supposed to keep it raised,"
she explained, cigarette waggling in her mouth as she picked up a full-cut glass ashtray and set it on her lap. District nurses in every day to change the dressings. Sit down.
What have you done? Asked Robin, squeezing past the coffee table to sit beside Lorraine on the sofa.
The Jack Russell immediately jumped up beside her and, mercifully, stopped barking.
I got a load of chip fat dropped on me, said Lorraine. At work.
Christ, said Strike, settling himself in the armchair. That must have been agony.
Yeah, it was. They say I'll be off at least a month.
At least it wasn't far to go to casualty.
Lorraine, it transpired, worked in the canteen of the local hospital.
So what's Donnie done?
Lorraine muttered, puffing smoke, once the subject of her injury had been thoroughly aired.
Robbery again, is it?
Why do you say that? Asked Strike carefully.
He robbed me, she said.
Robin saw now that the brusqueness was a facade. Lorraine's long cigarette trembled as she said it.
When was this? Asked Strike.
When he walked out, took all me jewellery, Mum's wedding ring, everything. He knew what that meant to me. She'd not been dead a year. Yet one day he just walks out of the house and never comes back. I called the police. I thought he'd had an accident. Then I realised my purse was empty and me jewellery was gone.
The humiliation had not left her. Her sunken cheeks flushed as she said it. Strike felt in the inside pocket of his jacket.
I want to make sure we're talking about the same man. Does this picture look familiar?
He handed her one of the photographs Lang's ex-mother-in-law had given him in Melrose. Big and broad in his blue and yellow kilt, with his dark ferret-like eyes and that low-sprouting crop of fox-red hair, Lang was standing outside a registry office. Rona clung to his arm, less than half his width, in what looked like a poorly fitting, possibly second-hand wedding gown. Lorraine examined the photograph for what seemed like a very long time. At last she said,
I think it's him. It could be.
You can't see it, but he had a big tattoo of a yellow rose on his left forearm, said Strike.
Yeah, said Lorraine heavily. That's right. He did.
She smoked, staring at the picture.
He'd been married, had he? She asked,
with a slight quaver in her voice.
Didn't he tell you? Asked Robin.
No.
Told me he'd never been.
How did you meet him? Asked Robin.
Pub, said Lorraine. He didn't look much like that when I knew him.
She turned in the direction of the sideboard behind her and made a vague attempt to get up.
Can I help? Robin offered. In that middle drawer, there might be a picture.
The Jack Russell began barking again as Robin opened a drawer containing an assortment of napkin rings, crochet doilies, souvenir teaspoons, toothpicks, and loose photographs. Robin extracted as many of the latter as she could and brought them back to Lorraine.
That's him, said Lorraine, after sorting through many pictures that mostly featured a very elderly woman who Robin assumed to be Lorraine's mother.
Lorraine passed the picture straight to Strike. He would not have recognized Lang if he had passed him in the street. The former boxer was massively swollen, especially around the face. His neck was no longer visible, his skin seemed tight, his features distorted. One arm was around a smiling Lorraine's shoulders, the other hung loose at his side. He was not smiling. Strike peered closer. The yellow rose tattoo was visible, but partially obscured by angry red skin plaques that mottled the whole expanse of his forearm.
Is there something wrong with his skin?
Psoriatic arthritis, said Lorraine. He was bad with it. That's why he was on the sick benefit. He had to stop work.
Yeah? Said Strike. What had he been working as before?
He come down here as a manager for one of the big construction firms, she said. But then he got ill and couldn't work. He'd had his own building company up in Melrose. He was the managing director.
Really? Said Strike.
Yeah, family business, said Lorraine,
searching a stack of photographs. He inherited it from his dad. There he is again, look. They were holding hands in this picture, which looked as though it had been taken in a beer garden. Lorraine beamed, and Lang looked blank, his moon face shrinking his dark eyes to slits. He had the characteristic look of a man on medically prescribed steroids. The hair, like a fox's pelt, was the same, but otherwise Strike was hard-pressed to make out the features of the fit young boxer who had once bitten his face.
"How long were you together?"
10 months. I met him right after Mum died. She was 92. She lived here with me. I was helping with Mrs. Williams next door and all. She was 87, senile, her son's in America. Donnie was good to her. He mowed her lawn and got shopping.
Bastard knew which side his bread was buttered, thought Strike.
Ill, unemployed and broke, as Lang had been at the time. A lonely middle-aged woman without dependents who could cook, who had her own house, who had just inherited money from her mother, must have been a godsend. It would have been worth faking a bit of compassion to get his feet under the table. Lang had had charm when he chose to use it.
"He seemed all right when we met," said Lorraine morosely. "Couldn't do enough for me then. He wasn't well himself, joints swollen and everything. He had to have injections off the doctor. He got a bit moody later, but I thought that was just his health. You don't expect ill people to be always cheerful, do you? Not everyone's like Mum. She was a bloody marvel. Her health was that bad, and she was always smiling and...
"Let me get you a tissue," said Robin. And she leaned slowly towards the crocheted-covered box so as not to disarrange the Jack Russell, which had its head on her lap.
"Did you report the theft of your jewellery?" Strike asked, once Lorraine had received her tissue, which she plied between deep drags on her Super King. "No," she said gruffly. "What was the point? They were never going to find it."
Robin guessed that Lorraine had not wanted to draw official attention to her humiliation and sympathized.
"Was he ever violent?"
Robin asked gently. Lorraine looked surprised.
"No." "Is that why you're here? Has he hurt someone?"
"We don't know," said Strike.
"I don't think he'd hurt anyone," she said. "He wasn't that kind of man. I said that to the police."
"Sorry," said Robin, stroking the now dozing Jack Russell's head. "I thought you didn't report the robbery."
"This was later," said Lorraine, "a month or so after he'd gone. Somebody broke into Mrs. Williams' place, knocked her out and robbed the house. The police wanted to know where Donnie was. I said, he's long gone, moved out. Anyway, he wouldn't do that, I told them. He'd been good to her. He wouldn't punch an old lady."
They had once held hands in a beer garden. He had mowed the old lady's lawn. She refused to believe Lang had been all bad.
"I assume your neighbour couldn't give the police a description?" Strike asked.
Lorraine shook her head.
"She never came back after. Died in her home. Got a family in Northfield now," said Lorraine. 3 little kids. You should hear the noise. And they've got the bloody cheek to complain about the dog."
They had hit a complete dead end. Lorraine had no idea where Lang had gone next. She could not remember him mentioning any place to which he was connected other than Melrose, and she had never met any of his friends. Once she had realized that he was never coming back, she had deleted his mobile number from her phone. She agreed to let them take the 2 photographs of Lang, but other than that, had no more help to offer. The Jack Russell protested loudly at Robin withdrawing her warm lap, and showed every sign of wishing to take his displeasure out on Strike as the detective rose from his chair.
"Stop it, Tigger,"
said Lorraine crossly, holding the struggling dog on the sofa with difficulty.
"We'll see ourselves out," Robin shouted, over the dog's frenzied barking. "Thanks so much for all your help."
They left her there in her cluttered, smoky sitting room, bandaged ankle raised, probably a little sadder and more uncomfortable for their visit. The sound of the hysterical dog followed them all the way up the garden path.
"I feel we could have at least made her a cup of tea or something," said Robin guiltily,
as they got back into the Land Rover.
"She doesn't know what a lucky escape she's had," said Strike bracingly. "Think about the poor old dear in there."
He pointed at Northfield,
beaten to shit for a couple of extra quid.
"You think that was Lang?"
"Of course it was bloody Lang,"
said Strike, as Robin turned on the engine.
"He'd cased the joint while he was supposedly helping her out, hadn't he? And you noticed that, for all he was supposed to be so ill with his arthritis, he was still capable of mowing lawns and half-killing old women."
Hungry and tired, her head aching from the stale cigarette smoke, Robin nodded and said that she supposed so. It had been a depressing interview, and the prospect of a further 2.5 hours' drive to get back home was not appealing.
"Do you mind if we get going?"
said Strike, checking his watch.
"I told Ellen I'll be over tonight."
"No problem," said Robin. Yet for some reason, perhaps due to her headache, perhaps because of the lonely woman sitting in Summerfield among the memories of loved ones who had left her, Robin could easily have wept all over again. Chapter 29. I Just Like to Be Bad. Sometimes he found it hard to be with the people who thought themselves his friends, the men with whom he associated when he needed money. Theft was their main occupation, tomming of a Saturday night their recreation. He was popular among them, a mate, so they thought, a fellow, an equal. An equal. The day the police had found her, all he had wanted was to be alone to savour the coverage. The stories in the paper made good reading. He felt proud. This was the first time he'd been able to kill in private, to take his time, to organise things as he'd wanted. He intended to do the same with the secretary, to have time to enjoy her alive before he killed her. His one frustration was there was no mention of the letters that were supposed to point the police to Strike, to make them interrogate and badger the fucker, drag his name through the mud in the papers, make the dumb public think he'd had something to do with it. However, there were columns and columns of coverage, photographs of the flat where he'd done her, interviews with the pretty boy police officer. He saved the stories. They were souvenirs, just like the bits of her he had taken for his private collection. Of course, his pride and enjoyment had to be hidden from it, because it required very careful handling at the moment. It wasn't happy, not happy at all. Life wasn't panning out the way it had expected, and he had to pretend to give a flying fuck, to be concerned, be a nice guy, because it was useful to him. It brought in money, and it might have to give him alibis. You never knew whether they might be needed. He'd had a close call once before. That had been the second time he had killed, in Milton Keynes. You didn't shit on your own doorstep. That had always been one of his guiding principles. He had never been to Milton Keynes before or since, and had no connection with the place. He had stolen a car, away from the boys, a solo job. He had had fake plates ready for a while. Then he had simply driven, wondering whether he would get lucky. There had been a couple of failed attempts since his first murder. Trying to chat up girls in pubs, in clubs, trying to isolate them, was not working as well as it had in the past. He didn't look as good as he once had, he knew that. But he didn't want to establish a pattern of doing prostitutes. The police started to put two and two together if you went for the same type every time. Once, he had managed to track a tipsy girl down an alleyway, but before he'd even drawn his knife out, a pair of giggling kids had burst into view and he had taken off. After that, he had given up on trying to pick up a girl in the usual way. It would have to be force. He had driven for hours in increasing frustration, not a whiff of a victim in Milton Keynes. At 10 to midnight, he was on the verge of caving and sniffing out a hooker when he'd spotted her. She was arguing with her boyfriend on a roundabout in the middle of the road, a short-haired brunette in jeans. As he passed, he kept an eye on the couple in his rearview mirror. He watched her storm away as good as intoxicated by her own anger and tears. The infuriated man she had left behind shouted after her, then, with a gesture of disgust, stumbled off in the opposite direction. He did a U-turn and drove back up the road towards her. She was sobbing as she walked, wiping her eyes on her sleeve. He had wound down the window.
"You're right, love. Piss off."
She sealed her fate by plunging angrily into the bushes beside the road to get away from his crawling car. Another 100 yards would have taken her to a well-lit stretch of road. All he had to do was turn off the road and park. He pulled on the balaclava before getting out of the car, the knife ready in his hand, and walked calmly back to the place where she had disappeared. He could hear her trying to fight her way out of the dense patch of trees and shrubs, placed there by town planners to soften the contours of the wide grey dual carriageway. There was no street lamp here. He was invisible to passing drivers as he skirted the dark foliage. As she beat her way back onto the pavement, he was standing ready to force her back in at knife point. He had spent an hour in the bushes before leaving the body. He ripped her earrings from her lobes and then wielded his knife with abandon, hacking off bits of her. A gap in the traffic, and he scurried, panting, back to the stolen car in the darkness, balaclava still in place. He drove away, every particle of him elated and sated, his pockets seeping. Only then did the mist lift. Last time, he had used a car from work, which he had subsequently cleaned thoroughly in full view of his workmates. He doubted anyone would be able to get the blood out of these cloth seats, and his DNA would be on everything. What was he going to do? That was the closest he had ever come to panicking. He drove miles north before abandoning the car in a lonely field far from the main road, not overlooked by any buildings. Here, shivering in the cold, he took off the fake plates, soaked one of his socks in the petrol tank, then chucked it into the bloody front seat and lit it. It took a long time for the car to properly catch. He had to reapproach it several times to help it along, until finally, at 3 in the morning, while he watched, shivering, from the cover of trees, it exploded. Then he ran. It was winter, which meant at least that the balaclava did not look out of place. He buried the fake plates in a wood and hurried on, head bowed, hands in his pockets on his treasured souvenirs. He had considered burying them too, but he could not bring himself to do it. He had covered the bloodstains on his trousers with mud, kept his balaclava on at the station, acting drunk in a corner of the train carriage to keep people away from him, muttering to himself, projecting that aura of menace and madness that acted like a cordon when he wished to be left alone. By the time he reached home, they had found her body. He watched it on the TV that night, eating off a tray in his lap. They found the burnt-out car but not the plates and... this really was proof of his own inimitable luck, the strange protective blessing the cosmos gave him. The boyfriend with whom she had argued was arrested, charged, and, though the evidence against him was transparently weak, convicted. The thought of that dickhead serving his time still made him laugh sometimes. Nevertheless, those long hours of driving through the darkness, when he had known an encounter with the police might be fatal, when he had feared a request to turn out his pockets, or a shrewd-eyed passenger noticing dried blood on him, had taught him a powerful lesson. Plan every detail. Leave nothing to chance. That was why he needed to nip out for some Vicks VapoRub. The number one priority right now was to make sure that its stupid new scheme did not interfere with his own. Chapter 30. I am gripped by what I cannot tell. Blue Oyster Cult, Lips in the Hills. Strike was inured to the shifts between frenetic activity and enforced passivity demanded by investigations. Nevertheless, the weekend following their round trip to Barrow, Market Harborough and Corby found him in a strange state of tension. The gradual re-immersion in civilian life that had taken place over the past couple of years had brought with it pressures from which he had been protected while in the military. His half-sister Lucy, the only sibling with whom he had shared a childhood, called early on Saturday morning to ask why he had not responded to her invitation to his middle nephew's birthday party. He explained that he had been away, unable to access mail sent to the office, but she barely listened.
"Jack Hero worships you, you know," she said. "He really wants you to come."
"Sorry, Lucy," said Strike. "Can't make it. I'll send him a present."
Had Strike still been in the SIB, Lucy would not have felt entitled to exert emotional blackmail. It had been easy to avoid family obligations then, while he was travelling the world. She had seen him as an inextricable part of the army's immense and implacable machine. When he steadily refused to yield to her word picture of a desolate 8-year-old nephew looking in vain for Uncle Cormoran at the garden gate, she desisted, asking instead how the hunt for the man who had sent the leg was progressing. Her tone implied that there was something disreputable about being sent a leg. Keen to get her off the phone, Strike told her untruthfully that he was leaving everything up to the police. Fond as he was of his younger sister, he had come to accept that their relationship rested almost entirely on shared and largely traumatic memories. He never confided in Lucy unless forced to do so by external events, for the simple reason that confidences usually elicited alarm or anxiety. Lucy lived in a state of perennial disappointment that he was still, at the age of 37, holding out against all those things that she believed necessary to make him happy. A job with regular hours, more money, a wife and children. Glad to have got rid of her, Strike made himself his third mug of tea of the morning and laid back down on the bed with a pile of newspapers. Several of them displayed a photograph of murder victim Kelsey Platt, wearing a Navy school uniform, a smile on her plain, pimply face. Dressed only in boxers, his hairy belly no smaller for the plentiful takeaways and chocolate bars that had filled it in the last fortnight, he munched his way through a packet of rich tea biscuits and skimmed several of the stories, but they told him nothing he did not already know. So he turned instead to the anticipatory comment about the next day's Arsenal-Liverpool match. His mobile rang while he was reading. He had not realized how tightly wound he was. He reacted so fast that Wardle was taken by surprise.
"Bloody hell, that was quick. What were you doing, sitting on it?" "What's going on?" "We've been over to Kelsey's sister's place. Name's Hazel, she's a nurse. We're looking into all Kelsey's day-to-day contacts. We've gone through her room and we've got her laptop. She's been online on some message board for people who want to hack bits off themselves. And she was asking about you."
Strike scratched his dense curly hair, staring at the ceiling, listening. "We've got personal details for a couple of the people she was interacting with regularly on the boards. I should have pictures by Monday. Where will you be?"
"Here, in the office."
"Her sister's boyfriend, the ex-fireman, says Kelsey kept asking him about people trapped in buildings and car accidents and all sorts. She really wanted to get rid of that leg."
"Jesus," muttered Strike.
After Wardle had hung up, Strike found himself unable to focus on the backroom reshuffles at the Emirates. After a few minutes, he abandoned the pretense that he was absorbed in the fate of Arsene Wenger's management team and resumed his staring at the cracks in the ceiling, absently turning his mobile over and over. In the blinding relief that the leg had not been Brittany Brockbank's, he had given less thought to the victim than he would ordinarily have done. Now, for the first time, he wondered about Kelsey and the letter that she had sent him, which he had not bothered to read. The idea of anybody seeking amputation was repugnant to Strike. Round and round in his hand he turned his mobile, marshalling everything he knew about Kelsey, trying to build a mental picture out of a name and mingled feelings of pity and distaste. She had been 16. She had not got on with her sister. She had been studying childcare. Strike reached for his notebook and began to write. "Boyfriend at college? Lecturer?" She had gone online, asking about him, Why? Where had she got the idea that he, Strike, had amputated his own leg? Or had she evolved a fantasy out of newspaper reports about him? Mental illness? Fantasist, he wrote. Wardle was already looking into her online contacts. Strike paused in his writing, remembering the photograph of Kelsey's head with its full cheeks in the freezer, staring out of its frosted eyes. Puppy fat. He had thought all along that she looked far too young for 24. In truth, she had looked young for 16. He let his pencil fall and continued to turn his mobile over and over in his left hand, thinking. Was Brockbank a true paedophile, as a psychologist Strike had met in the context of another military rape case had put it? Was he a man who was only sexually attracted to children? Or was he a different kind of violent abuser? A man who targeted young girls merely because they were most readily available and easiest to cow into silence, but who had wider sexual tastes if an easy victim became available? In short, was a babyish-looking 16-year-old too old to appeal sexually to Brockbank, or would he rape any easily silenced female if he got the chance? Strike had once had to deal with a 19-year-old soldier who had attempted to rape a 67-year-old. Some men's violent sexual nature required only opportunity. Strike had not yet called the number that Ingrid had given him for Brockbank. His dark eyes drifted to the tiny window that showed a feebly sunlit sky. Perhaps he should have passed Brockbank's number to Wardle. Perhaps he ought to call it now. Yet even as Strike began to scroll down the list of contacts, he reconsidered. What had he achieved so far by confiding his suspicions to Wardle? Nothing. The policeman was busy in his operations room, doubtless sifting leads, busy with his own lines of inquiry and giving Strikes, as far as the private detective could tell, only slightly more credence than he would have given anyone who had hunches, but no proof. The fact that Wardle, with all his resources, had not yet located Brockbank, Lang, or Whittaker, did not suggest that he was prioritizing the men. No. If Strike wanted to find Brockbank, he ought surely to maintain the cover that Robin had created, that of the lawyer looking to win the ex-major compensation. The traceable backstory they had created with his sister in Barrow might prove valuable. In fact, thought Strike, sitting up on the bed, it might be an idea to call Robin right now and give her Brockbank's number. She was alone, he knew, in the Ealing flat, while Matthew was home in Masson. He could call and perhaps... Oh, no, you don't, you silly fucker. A vision of himself and Robin in the Tottenham had bloomed in his head, a vision of where a phone call might lead. They were both at a loose end. A drink to discuss the case. On a Saturday night, piss off. Strike got up suddenly, as though the bed had become painful to lie on, dressed, and headed out to the supermarket. On his way back into Denmark Street, carrying bulging plastic bags, he thought he spotted Wardle's plainclothes policeman, stationed in the area to keep an eye out for large men in beanie hats. The young man in a donkey jacket was hyper-aware, his eyes lingering a tad too long on the detective as he walked past, his shopping swinging. Ellen called Strike much later, after he had eaten a solitary evening meal in his flat. As usual, Saturday night was out of bounds for a meeting. He could hear her daughter playing in the background as she talked. They had already arranged to see each other for dinner on Sunday, but she had called to ask whether he fancied meeting her earlier. Her husband was determined to force the sale of the valuable flat in Clarence Terrace, and she had started looking for a new property. "Do you want to come and look at it with me?" she asked. "I've got an appointment at the show flat tomorrow at 2:00. He knew, or thought he knew, that the invitation sprang not from some eager hope that he would one day be living with her there, they had only been dating for 3 months, but because she was a woman who would always choose company when possible. Her air of cool self-sufficiency was misleading. They might never have met had she not preferred to attend a party full of her brother's unknown colleagues and friends, rather than spend a few hours alone. There was nothing wrong with that, of course. Nothing wrong with being sociable, except that for a year now, Strike had organized